Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, April 2nd, and our agenda for today has really changed, and I apologize for that because I thought scheduling everything early, we could maybe get forthcoming and get quite a bit done, especially out of Ledge Council. But so I want to let you know that all the 450 bills, that's 451, 452, 453, 454, 455, and 456, and 457 will be carried over till Tuesday. We are going to talk briefly about 456, some we have no fiscal revenue, some we have new amendments coming in, and so that's why we're carrying it over till Tuesday. But we will be talking a little bit about 456. Is that the only one that we were going to be talking about? So that's where we are with that. So the evening meeting that we scheduled is canceled tonight because of all of the meetings. So that means 316, Senate Bill 316 is being carried over. That's the clinical trials. And 529, which is the human services. And I think Mr. Shook has contacted most of those that are affected by those two bills. So, but which bill were you going to address?
701.
No, way in the back.
456.
Yes. Okay. I knew. Okay. All right. With that, I would like to open a public hearing on 701. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, and Mr. Shook, do you want to quickly?
Oh, sure. Senate Bill 701 changes nursing services program to nursing faculty loan repayment program. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to come to you today to testify in support of Senate Bill 701 with the Dash 1 amendments. Much has been documented and reported on the national shortage of qualified clinical nurses. Oregon is facing the same shortage, but the state also faces another shortage. That is the nursing educators, those responsible for training the caregivers of tomorrow. Colleagues, over the last couple of bienniums, probably over the last several bienniums, we have increased nurse educator programs, we have built new buildings, but new buildings don't put an educator actually in the building. And that is a critical shortage. You can create all the programs you want, build all the facilities that you want, and unless you have the nurse educators to actually teach the nursing programs, it is all for naught. Senate Bill 701 and the Dash 1 amendments address this shortage by creating the nurse faculty loan repayment. Senate Bill 701 allows eligible and interested nurses who have earned either a master's or doctoral degree from accredited nursing programs to enter the nursing faculty loan repayment program. To qualify for this program, the applicant must have a faculty job teaching nursing in Oregon. The way that this credit would work, the way the nursing faculty loan repayment program would work, is for a master's candidate, they would have up to one-third of their loan repaid, up to a maximum of $10,000 per year for 3 years. For a doctoral candidate, they would have one-fifth of their loans paid, up to a maximum of $10,000 per year for 5 years. This would actually also require them, obviously, to continue teaching at that time. Faculty shortages at nursing schools in Oregon and across the country are limiting student capacity at a time when the need for nurses continues to grow. I would also tell you that I think, as the chair well knows, and probably all of you well know, but I'm sure Senator Bates knows this very well also, that nurses with graduate degrees that choose to teach choose also to take a significant pay cut because We actually pay our educators far less than our practitioners. I would urge the committee to support Bill 701 with the -1 amendments.
Senator Devlin, there are -2s evidently coming too, and so we will be talking about that at another time then.
And Madam Chair, I'm sure that the committee understands, I know you've all been talked to, when the bill was originally drafted, there was a drafting error that basically took out another good program and put this one in. The intent is to have both programs.
Okay. And so will you be all right with the -2s?
Madam Chair, there are a lot of people supporting this bill beyond me. They have probably prepared the -2s. I have not seen them.
Okay. And we have not either.
So, Madam Chair, on the summary that I wrote, it does say replacing the nursing service program. I don't think that's true, is it? Doesn't replace it?
No, it is not. It is it's probably, people don't like me probably reiterating how this happened, but a draft was sent to Legislative Council by the proponents to make it clear what was being drafted. Certain other lines in the existing law were crossed out so it could be highlighted. Legislative Council, rightfully, to be honest, thought that that was an indication that those other areas of the statute should be removed. So they inadvertently removed a very good program also. So the -1 and -2s, I believe probably both restore that program.
Thank you very much, Senator Devlin. With that, I'll call Chris Campbell, Joanne Warner, and Paula Gubrud-Howe. Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. I'm Chris Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Nursing. And you have my prepared testimony about the nurse faculty shortage as well as the Oregon Center for Nursing's research on the faculty shortage in Oregon on the nurse faculty workforce. My role this morning is to go through the elements of Senate Bill 701. Which is to establish a loan repayment program, especially in Section 2 here. The purpose of the program is to provide loan repayment on behalf of nurse educators at nursing schools in Oregon who have earned a master's or doctoral degree from an accredited nursing education program. To be eligible, they must have a faculty position and have served in that position for 1 year before they get their first year of loan repayment. We define how the loan repayment will be structured also in Section 2 and on the second page. At the end of each school year, they will receive their payment after having served as faculties.
And you are referring to the -1s?
Yes. Thank you very much. Yes. Yes, thank you. So they will. The loan repayment is $10,000 a year, up to $10,000 a year. 3 years for a master's degree, and up to 5 years repayment for a doctoral degree in nursing. There's a cost of living according to the Consumer Price Index, and then in. Section 4, it states that the program will be administered by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
And where is that located?
Okay. That is in Section 4. Six. A. So it's line 14.
Of the original bill.
Of the -1.
It's also in the amendment. Where?
Oh, you're looking at a different. We have an original bill, and then we don't have Section 4 on the -1 amendments that
that you have. So you must have a hand in gross version, which we do not have. So if you go to the original bill, because it doesn't look like you had changed anything on Section 4 in the original bill.
I think that was the problem with the initial drafting of the bill that Senator Devlin spoke to.
In Section 4, and that will be coming out in... Well, we don't have Section 4 in the Dash 2, so if you would go to the original bill to help us out.
Senator Montes Anderson, Elizabeth
Bushlaw. For the record.
For the record. Elizabeth Bushlaw.
No, your name.
Pardon me, Senator?
Introduce yourself.
Yeah, she did. She just did.
Again, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa, representing the Northwest Health Foundation. We're working on the nurse faculty shortage. What we had done, and I apologize to the committee, is to aid our able testifiers. We hand-engrossed a bill and printed it up so they could look at it the way it should look. Unfortunately, you do not have that, which is where the confusion lies. So essentially what is happening is if you'll just kind of ignore the section-by-section numbered walkthrough, Dr. Campbell is just explaining to you exactly what the amendments do in general. So if you will just not be concerned about the section numbers per se, the content of what she's saying is what the amendments do.
Thank you. And the Oregon Student Assistance Fund is with the State Treasury.
That's correct.
Thank you. Okay.
My apologies. And that those are the elements of the bill. It's to get faculty into positions now so we have the faculty to teach.
Thank you.
And my partners here, Dr. Werner and Dr. Gubrud, will tell you a little bit about why they need those faculty.
Excellent. Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Joanne Warner. I serve as the Dean of Nursing at the University of Portland, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the realities and implications of the nursing faculty shortage from the private independent college perspective. My written testimony provides background on what we have done and the need. We have expanded our resources and expanded our enrollment to do what we can for the nursing shortage. We have tripled our enrollment. We have innovated with clinical teaching models. We have utilized simulation. We have pulled out all the stops to do what we can so that Oregon has the workforce in nursing that we need. The kernel of my testimony is that the bottleneck that exists is in faculty, in nursing faculty. We expanded our program so that we now are year-round. So while many schools are getting ready for a sleepy summer, we're gearing up for a full semester. Our summer semester starts May 12. I do not have all the faculty yet in place for my summer. And I do this every semester, working to maintain the quality and the integrity of our program while I kind of scramble to find people who are adequately prepared and will do what I think is the high calling of teaching education. So the kernel of my testimony is to ask for your support of 701, that you would partner with us in what we see as the first step in improving the nursing education capacity within Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paula Gubrud, and I'm with the Oregon Health Science University School of Nursing, and I'm also a project coordinator for the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. Like the private sector, the public sector has responded to the nursing shortage. We've doubled enrollment through the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. We've created the possibilities of sharing faculty, sharing resources between colleges, and we've also streamlined the mobility for students from the associate degree to the baccalaureate, which then leads to graduate education, thereby creating a pipeline for new nurse faculty. As Joanne pointed out, Dr. Warner pointed out, the biggest bottleneck right now is the lack of access to nursing faculty. And I have one story to share with you that really brings the point home. One of our consortium community colleges on the South Coast has really struggled with recruiting and retaining faculty. They recently, about 2 years ago, recruited a young, newly master-prepared faculty who was excited to teach. She taught for 2 years, did assume a significant load, debt load while going to school, took a significant pay cut in order to assume the teaching position, which she loved. The college spent 2 years grooming her as she moved along her trajectory as a new professor. And then a local hospital came and offered her a position for almost twice the salary. And because of the debt load and the salary, she took it. Hence, the School of Nursing is now struggling to fill their faculty positions again. So that's just one story, but it's a common story that we're hearing over and over again.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So
relating to that story, I understand, and I was told by the president of Lane Community College, Mary Spilde, that there is an agreement with the hospital, at least in our area, to share a nurse, and that they would help subsidize, so to speak, the salary so that person could teach. Now, is that widespread?
It is fairly widespread, but it's regional, and it there's a lot of variables that affect the ability to do that.
So you want this loan repayment fund to come out of general fund, or do you have other creative ways on putting money into this loan repayment?
Madam Chair, I think we're looking at general fund.
Have you even thought about other creative ways, working with the hospitals, working with
Chairman Sanderson, we have
other stakeholders?
We've had tremendous partnerships with our clinical partners to support all of the program expansion that we have already enacted in this state. With the economic downturn, I think it's really challenging to get additional actual funding. They are still supporting us by with their clinicians helping to teach the students, but we have not approached them for funding for the faculty. They are supporting faculty in many ways already.
We don't have a fiscal yet. What do you think that this is? I know this is a Ways and Means question, mm-hmm. but what do you think the fiscal will be?
Well, the original intent for this was to be about $800,000, understanding that it would ramp up over time. If, for example, we had 25 or 30 faculty that we could get into positions next year at $10,000 a person, it certainly wouldn't be at the $800,000 mark, with also about $50,000 for the Student Assistance Commission to be able to administer the program.
Thank you.
As part of that.
Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much. Jennifer Spears, Susan Wentworth, and Kay, is it Conigal?
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you to Chair Mona Sanderson and the committee for taking the time to hear about this important issue today. I am Kay Carnegie. I am a registered nurse, and I have my master's in nursing. My current position, I'm the Associate Dean of Health Sciences at Chemeketa Community College here in Salem. And I've been in nursing education for 27 years. And I have to say I've loved every minute of it. And it was special today that one of my students is one of the other presenters. I hadn't seen her in several years. Today I'm here in support of Senate Bill 701, which proposes a nurse faculty school loan repayment program. I see this as a proactive means of addressing the nursing faculty shortage in Oregon and also addressing the registered nurse shortage that the nation faces. I oftentimes speak with nurse. It seems like I'm always recruiting for nurse faculty, and I'll talk with nurses that are interested in teaching, but they do not feel that they can afford the investment of approximately $30,000 a year to go get their master's or doctorate. A master's would take them a couple years, and a doctorate probably at least 3 years. And then on top of that, the other issue that always comes up is that they're either an associate degree nurse or a bachelor's nurse at that point, and the salary that they're getting in their current position is higher than what I can tell them I could pay them as a master's or doctorate prepared nurse educator. And in recent years, I'd say the situation has gotten a lot worse. And part of that is that a lot of faculty that had been teaching for several years have retired. And so the issue just keeps getting worse and worse. And I can give you some specifics at Chemeca that over the last 3 years, we've had 3 to 4 of our faculty positions open every year, and we only have 15 full-time faculty. So it's a very high percentage. And then when you look at the applicant pool that you're getting for those positions, you get about 3 to 6 people applying. So the pool for nursing faculty is pretty small. And I think as a result of that, we are also seeing a higher turnover of our new hires, that they do teaching for a year or two and they decide that that's way too much work for the pay that they're getting. And as a previous presenter said, what happens is they're offered a higher paying position outside of nursing education, and so they leave. So that really has become a retention issue for the schools. And it puts a lot of pressure on our seasoned faculty in that they're having to reorient new colleagues every year. We go through that. And I think the students also are impacted because they're getting a lot of new nursing faculty each year that are still learning some of the basics of nursing education. So to address these problems, Chemeca in fall of 2007 started a educational loan repayment program, and it has been very successful. We have hired 3 nursing faculty under that program, and each one of them have told me that without that program, there was no way they would have been able to take the position at Chemeca. So we still have 3 currently, and I'm feeling really good about that. Our program is that it will pay up to $40,000 for them if they're a clinical instructor or a nursing instructor to get their master's in nursing or a doctorate in nursing, and then they can start paying back when they finish the program. And if they work for 48 months after the completion of their program, they basically pay off their loan. So I think we have a good program, and I'm really happy to hear that this is being looked at, because I think it would be really successful for all the schools in Oregon. So thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
It's interesting because last week we heard people talk about how nurses are leaving hospitals because it's overload, too much work, not enough people. Where are they going? I mean,
well, nursing is okay, getting harder, I think.
Well, on one hand, they're saying there's a nursing shortage. On the other hand, they're saying, no, there's not a nursing shortage. It's just that they don't hire enough nurses in hospitals in order to balance the load so people will stay in hospitals. Now, it's kind of interesting because we're getting somewhat contradictory testimony. If they leave teaching to find a higher paying job, are they going into a hospital then to find a higher, or what other?
It depends. Some of them do that. Some of them are nurse practitioners, may go to clinics. So there's a variety. Some of them go to administration and clinics or community settings. But we have lost some to hospitals where they go and do like training of nurses in the hospital. So it's kind of a variety.
And where does your funding then come from for the loan repayment program?
Well, it has been in general fund, and now
the college is
at the college, and I don't know the future of this program because of you're all aware of the education funding, so we'll see. But it's been good while we've had it, at least.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, committee and Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Spear, and I'd like to thank you for allowing me to come and give my testimony about Senate Bill 701. I am a registered nurse with a bachelor's in the science of nursing degree. I am also a member of my professional organization, the Oregon Nurses Association. And I have been a bedside care nurse for 8 years. I started my career taking care of cardiac patients, those that are very ill and usually facing the end of, you know, possibly the end of their life at times. And most recently, I have become a labor and delivery nurse. So I'm taking care of typically very healthy women, and they are also celebrating the beginning of life. I feel I've been able to take care of this wide variety of patients because of my nurse educators. They taught me the importance of compassionate care, that nursing is more than just a practice, it is also an art, and that their knowledge, excitement, and passion for nursing molded me into the professional that I am today. I personally want to pass that on to future nurses, to the next generation of nurses, and so that's why I'm here to speak in support of the Senate Bill 701. I personally have had several barriers to going back to school. Every student, when they go back, has time constraints and family pressures when they go back to school. Nurses often face the need to cut back on their hours in order to dedicate the time that they need to get everything that they can out of their education. For me, it's not an option. I am the sole income earner for my family of three, and so I have to work while I'm if I were to go back to school. And so what would be normally a two-year program for most would then become a four-year program because I'd have to go part-time while I'm working. The problem that I have with that is that not only I have to look at cost because I'm not earning as much because I'm working part-time, but also the burden on my family from being away or having to spend time with my studies. So besides the immediate financial and time and personal burdens, I also face the long-term financial burdens because as everybody has been pointing out, I most likely will be making less money than I am now as a bedside care nurse, and knowing that earnings potential will make it harder to repay an increased level of debt that I would incur is one of the largest disincentives for me returning to school to become a nurse educator. I also think that there's another piece of the Senate bill that will allow the state to address some problems with the healthcare system. And so my thinking, or the reason why I feel that way, is that I start with the patient. I'm a bedside nurse. I believe that the patient is who I'm there to serve, and that is why I became a nurse. So when we look at nurses, when we look at patients, we know that they need to have a good nurse to help them navigate their way through healthcare, through the hospital systems, through their disease process, and all of their support. So we know that there's also a nursing shortage or an impending nursing shortage that's growing. So we need to have more nurses. And as my colleagues have said, we have done a really good job about opening up programs and making that available for people to go into nursing. But I'm also hearing from the students that I mentor at the bedside who say, I have friends who can't get in. They're on a waiting list. And I'm like, well, why can't they get in? And what I have found is that there's just not the educators that are there to be able to teach them. So the schools are limited in the number of applicants that they can actually take. So if there aren't enough qualified educators, then we need to have something in place to help incentivize the nurses into becoming nurse educators. find a way to allow those people who really want to do that to be able to enter into those programs. So I guess my question is, if Oregon can't meet the current demand for registered nurses, then how are we going to meet the future demands with the projected nurse and nurse faculty retirement rates over the next two decades? And my answer is, or at least what I think a piece of it is start by supporting the nurses and support. And one of the ways of supporting this bill is by allowing those nurses to do what they love to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, Senator Morse?
Well, I'll wait till the panel's done.
Let's wait till the panel's done.
Okay. I will, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for paying special attention to this bill that I personally feel is really essential. My name is Susan Wentworth, and I am currently a graduate student at the Oregon Health Sciences University in the nurse education program. I started just this past fall. I actually graduated from Kay's program at Chemeketa in 1999, worked as a bedside nurse for several years, decided because of my experience as a preceptor or a mentor of new orientees and student nurses, and the success that I had and was told that I had with those nurses, I decided that my calling was nursing education. The difficulty with making that decision was that while I was working here at Salem Hospital, the last, you know, when you get your Social Security things back, I was surprised to find that I made $72,000 one year as a bedside nurse. So by making the decision to become a nurse educator, I will take, I'd be lucky to get 50. So that that's a big decision in that process. Now, in order to go to school, I dropped down part-time to accommodate the hours. Actually, I had to go on call because the hospital could not accommodate my school times that I needed to go to class. So I needed to change so that I could have more control over my schedule. So I lost benefits as well. Away from my testimony here, but I just wanted to add, school costs at Oregon Health Sciences University for just the credit hours only over $20,000. That's just the credit hours. Now, each time that you go per term, it's another $1,000 on fees on top of that per term. So if you stretch things out and go 3 or 4 years, you're adding $1,000 per term. The closest you can, the quickest you could get through is four terms if you go full time, and that's full time. And you can't possibly work and go to school full time. When I was trying to decide to actually do this, I really struggled with the decision. I would be giving up the possibility of making hospital wages, but also taking on this debt was a difficult decision to make. And I talked with the faculty there. They told me about this bill, that it might actually happen. And so I took the leap and decided to go ahead and take out the loans to go to school. I feel like nursing education is a calling for me. I am passionate about nursing. I am passionate about teaching critical thinking, which I think is the crux of nursing. And I don't think that it's... I think it's it's something that a true nurse really wants to pass on her craft to those around so that we can, as a force, continue to raise the bar on health care. And I want to tell you, too, I drove all the way from Astoria to tell you this morning. So I'm very, very committed to this, and I just want to thank you for listening to me and hearing my point of view. Thank you very much for your attention to this.
Thank you very much. Okay, now Senator Bates, or Senator Morrison, and then Senator Bates.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
the purpose of this bill is very, very important, and I agree with it. The hurdle will be the source of funding. Mm-hmm. And my question is, if, as I read the information, if we have approximately 44,000 registered nurses in the state, the nexus seems to be closer to those who receive the benefit of an education to help fund the educators for that education. And I'm wondering, if you're looking at approximately $20 a year, call it whatever you may, maybe an education surcharge to a fee for the license that would raise the monies to put into this fund in the Treasury, would the nursing profession support that kind of a funding mechanism? Because just honestly, where we would get $1 million out of the general fund in this, that's your business.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm concerned that this bill would die for lack of a source out of general fund monies. So that would be my question, is that nexus seen and realized within those who receive the benefit of an education to support those who would provide that education?
I might just make one comment about that. I've had students come to me and that weren't getting into the program because we weren't finding faculty, so we had to limit our numbers. And they said, I wish we could put money into some pot to help pay for some faculty positions. So I think your idea really isn't that off base from what I'm hearing some current students that are trying to get into programs are saying. So it's something I think for the nursing all of us to consider.
Senator Bates?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Morris, I think it's a great idea, and I had also heard from students trying to get into programs, I pay a little higher tuition to get in. It's a good investment in my future. Mm-hmm. I think looking at both these issues would probably be a way to bring the funds available to do this program. I did some quick math in my head, and that's always a danger. Okay. How many registered nurses do we have in the state? I thought it was around
35,000.
About
40,000. It's 40,000
now.
45,000.
For the record, since people didn't hear her way, that it's 40,000 registered nurses and 4,000 licensed practical nurses.
So, I mean, you're looking at, you know, maybe $20 on to a license every year. You're looking at maybe, you know, increase in a small amount in student fees, all going into a fund which would open these programs up for you. It's something we should look at very carefully, Madam Chair. I'll go down to LFO once again, and they'll be glad to see my smiling face, and we'll do some number crunching, and maybe we can offer an amendment that might make sense in ways and means for you in this and get this thing off the ground and get it rolling. The other question I have is for both for Jennifer and Susan. First, I want to say that Dr. Campbell and I had a really great conversation in my office a month or two ago. Now, my time warp is terrible. This session is, I can't tell. And we talked about the importance of nurses coming in who have hands-on experience first and then going into a master program. You are exactly who we want to be running these programs. I mean, your experience is invaluable. You have real experience. But admittedly, you need to have the knowledge to be able to teach, too, and to broaden your perspective. You know, if you're a cardiology nurse, there's, you know, people on medical floors, there's outpatient services, there's emergency room services, OB. You need to be able to be broader in your training. What kind of surprised me is that you're talking about a two-year program to get your master's degree. Most programs for master's degrees, and I may be wrong about this too, are usually a one-year or a program about that nature, about 1 year. And we have reentry programs for teaching programs that are clearly 1 year coming from professions. I was kind of surprised it's a two-year program. That's a tough commitment. So I'd like to hear a little more about that. Is there some way of bringing that in a one-year full-time heavy-duty program, or does it have to be a full two-year program? That's pretty heavy-duty.
May I speak to that?
Yes, please.
My experience is that it took me just a little over 3 years to get through the associate's degree program. I worked as a staff nurse at Salem Hospital for over 5 years in various departments, starting with critical care all the way to med-surg. And then I went to the bachelor's, RN to bachelor's program at Oregon Health Sciences University, and that took me just 7 terms to get through, I believe. And so that's a couple of years there. And then I am going part-time through the Master's of Education program. I will graduate June of 2010. I started last fall. So it's 2 years going part-time, taking approximately 8 hours per term. It's about a 50 credit program. So you can divide that up and straight through with no summer break.
Well, I think that the point that Senator Bates was making is that, you know, the Oregon Center for Nursing had done yeoman's work on doing some refiguration of entry requirements for nursing, for the nursing program, so that wherever you took your courses, this is just another issue that the leadership, nursing leadership, should take on regarding mm-hmm. the length, if there's some kind of consolidation.
Yeah, I think if I'm hearing it, I don't know if they're on a semester or quarter-hour program, but it sounds to me like if you were able to go full-time, and many, obviously you can't because you have to work your way through, mm-hmm. you might be able to get through it in a year, a little over, okay. or a little less than a year, or about a year. The problem is you got to make a living, mm-hmm. and so it becomes a 3 or 4 year trudge to get through it all.
It's 4 terms full-time at Oregon Health Sciences University.
Are the terms quarters or semesters?
4 quarters.
Quarters.
So
okay.
It's beginning in September, ending the following December.
It's essentially a one-year program going full-time. Mm-hmm. That seems very reasonable. It's just hard to fit that into a working schedule and driving in from a story. Would you get up at 4 a.m.?
That's dedication, okay. And you're speaking better than I could at 4 a.m.
We've taken 45 minutes, and it was only supposed to take 30 minutes for this testimony. So if we could move to the next panel, and then and that is Carol Dodson and Alan Moore.
Amendment.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and Committee. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify. My name is Carol Dodson, and I am currently a full-time faculty of nursing at Clackamas Community College. I began that position in 2001 when I had just completed my master's program at OHSU with the full intent of opening a private practice as a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I've been a nurse for over 30 years and originally went through a diploma program of nursing, returned to get my baccalaureate degree, and then ultimately my master's. I did not intend to teach. However, a friend of mine who was working at Clackamas kept saying, please come and talk to our nursing department about teaching. And I said, you know, I would love to consider teaching because I've taught in other venues, but I don't think I can afford to take the pay cut that I would have to do. And, you know, if I'm going to be working as a psychiatric nurse practitioner, I could be compensated quite a bit more. But to mostly quiet her, I did go out and speak to the faculty at Clackamas and was very taken with their philosophy of teaching, and no one was more surprised than I that I applied for and was hired into that position in 2001. At that time, as a full-time faculty, I was very fortunate to not come in at the bottom rung of the pay scale. Yeah. I came in at one step above, and that meant that I was not coming in at $36,000 a year full-time, but at $42,000, which was much less than what my graduating students, the minute they walked out of an ADN program, would be making. And I had, at that time, almost 28 years of nursing experience and now had a master's degree. I had to, at the same time, open a private practice as a nurse practitioner to meet my financial obligations, and I did both jobs for as a private practice and teaching for 7 years. 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and at that time was able to take some time off from teaching and had to close my private practice as a nurse practitioner. And now I'm at that junction of trying to decide what to do, because teaching was what my heart said to do, but it's not the best financial decision for myself. And so I'm at a point in which I'm trying to decide, should I continue teaching at Clackamas, or should I open a practice again as a nurse practitioner and do that full time? We are a small faculty at Clackamas, and all but one of us are in our 50s. So we are all sort of coming towards the end of the working career. And when I started at Clackamas in 2001, all of the faculty had retired over a two-year period due to being at retirement age. And it is very difficult to find qualified people who can come in and bring to a program what students need. Being a good bedside nurse does not mean that one is a good educator in a classroom. And it takes time to hone those skills. And I feel that for trying to bring qualified people into teaching, having them complete a master's program, as you've heard from other witnesses this morning, it is an expensive venture to receive a nursing education. And when you are looking at what your compensation is ultimately going to be, there are many other options for nurses in this day and age and that are better compensated. I love my job teaching, and I would hate to have to leave it. But at the age of 56, with a lot of school debt still, which will take me many, many years to pay off, and then ultimately other debt due to my illness, I am at a point where I have to think about my future. And just as an addendum, recently at Clackamas, due to the financial, to the budget constraints, we as a faculty, an entire faculty across campus, we voted to not take our cost of living increase. We voted to take a pay cut. And so we are going backwards. And I realize that many people are in very difficult situations financially now. It's not just faculty, but it is just one more point of the difficult situation that people are finding to make that decision to take a teaching position. So I thank you for considering the Senate Bill 701, and I hope that I think some of the ideas brought forth this morning about adding fees to the license, I think that's an excellent idea. You know, I realize we have to be creative in looking at our funding, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alan Moore. I work for and represent the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. We represent 3,000 healthcare professionals, including 1,800 registered nurses, nurse practitioners, and certified nurse midwives who work for Kaiser Permanente and Providence Health and Services. As you know, Oregon faces a shortage of nurses in both the present and future due to multiple factors, including an aging workforce, a shortage of nursing faculty, and working conditions that cause even the most dedicated nurses to consider leaving the bedside in favor of other opportunities. Senate Bill 701 is a helpful step forward, providing some support for registered nurses who desire to become nurse educators at Oregon's nursing schools. As you know, the current shortage of nursing faculty is one of the factors that contributes to the nursing shortage. Currently, and for many years previously, Oregon's nursing schools have had far more applicants than they've had space to accommodate, as a number of people have testified. The result is that many potentially high-quality registered nurses are turned away from the profession. This includes many experienced healthcare workers who are dedicated to serving the healthcare needs of Oregonians, but due to the shortage of educational opportunities, are not able to pursue their dreams of becoming registered nurses. In order to address these concerns, OFNHP has worked collaboratively with Kaiser Permanente and a number of schools of nursing, including Clackamas Community College, in the Portland metro area to create innovative programs that allow currently employed healthcare workers to maintain their employment while they pursue nursing degrees, and this is both associate's level and bachelor's. Among the barriers that we have faced include educational programs that are not designed to accommodate working adults and a shortage of nursing faculty that impairs the ability of nursing schools to accommodate and design the design and implementation of innovative programs such as we've tried to do with Kaiser Permanente. Among the barriers that nurses face when they decide to pursue advanced education in order to pursue a career path as a nurse educator include lack of programs to support their endeavor, a shortage of faculty to actually train the future nurse educators, and as you've heard, the comparatively low salaries of nurse faculty make comparison to nurses actively working both in direct patient care and in other opportunities that are presented to nurses with advanced degrees. By partially addressing the funding issue and targeting it to RNs who will actually engage in teaching after finishing their graduate program, Senate Bill 701 is a positive contribution towards resolving these concerns, and on behalf of OFNHP, I encourage the committee to not only approve this bill, but to address the other barriers that nurses pursuing nurse education as a career choice face. But unfortunately, focusing primarily on the supply of nurses without adequately addressing what causes nurses to leave direct patient care is not likely to solve the shortage of nurses that Oregon faces. Among the OFNHP membership, over 40% of the registered nurses are either eligible to retire or will be within 5 years. The dynamic within our membership mirrors the Oregon and national trends as the nurse population continues to age. The pending wave of retirements will coincide with the baby boom generation entering their retirement years and simultaneously demanding increased nursing care. Nationally, the shortage by 2020 is projected to be between 300,000 and 400,000 nurses. The first response to such projection may be an attempt to increase the supply of new registered nurses in hopes of filling the current and future vacancies. But given the fiscal reality of our educational institutions, it seems unlikely there will be enough of an increase in nursing school capacity to ever fill the widening gap between the supply of nurses and demand for nurses by healthcare institutions. When you peek below the statistics and projections of nursing vacancies, it quickly becomes apparent that the reality of our situation is not one of a nationwide shortage of nurses per se, but rather a shortage of nurses willing to practice in the conditions that have come to define the nursing profession in Oregon and in the United States at large. Numerous studies have demonstrated that there are enough registered nurses with current licenses to fill the vast majority of vacant nursing positions. Studies have also shown that nearly 40% of nurses plan to leave their current job within 2 years, many leaving direct patient care or the profession entirely. Unfortunately, the nurses newest to the career field are the most likely to consider leaving in reaction to the conditions they find upon entering the profession as they begin bedside nursing. And the realities of the profession cause these nurses to pursue other career alternatives, which exacerbates the nurse shortage and increasing demand on our overstretched nursing schools.
Can you sum up?
Yes, I can. You have before you this bill to address this, Senate Bill 564, which is established ratios in our hospitals. Our neighbors the South have discovered what happened when they did that is nurses returned to the profession, and the number of licensed nurses in California jumped up dramatically. So while we encourage you to approve this bill, we encourage you to continue to look at Oregon's healthcare workforce problems holistically. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. All right. I think that I'd like to read into the record. Written testimony was submitted by Beverly Jensen, an associate professor of nursing at Umpqua, and Michelle Smith, who is a registered nurse baccalaureate at the University of Portland, and she's been working with Providence Child Center. So that is for the record. Thank you very much. I think we need to let Anna know and Senator Devlin's office know that it would be nice to work with the leadership, nursing leadership, regarding other alternatives. You may not be able to come up with alternatives that you feel are, but you would need to bring the Board of Nursing in on this too if we're looking at fees. And then, of course, the community colleges regarding tuition. Just to see if there's anything else that you can address here.
All right. With that, I would like to thank you very much. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 701, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 400. Colleagues, would you want to remind us, Mr. Shook, what this bill is about?
Yes, I would like to, if I can find it. Oh, thank you. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 400, we had a public hearing about a month ago. It authorizes State Fish and Wildlife Commission to issue at no charge resident disabled war veterans a shellfish license to person who files with the commission written proof that the last official certification of record by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs or by any branch of armed forces of the United States shows person to be at least 25% disabled.
And Madam Chair, the Dash 1 amendment takes that to 30% because that is how they're recorded in percentages with zeros, not percentages with fives. So, and I've also discovered, Madam Chair, that 30% disability is pretty severe disability.
Madam Chair, there is a number of years ago, there was a fishing license. Same concept, but not shellfish, but
it was everything.
And
it was
and that in statute is 25.
It is, which is fine. But I just thought it would be cleaner to have the percentages that the department recognizes. So We maybe should have cleaned up the other one as well. But it's working. So you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, I guess. So
For some reason, I can't see where our fiscal is. Do we have one.
It's minimal.
It's minimal. It is the 400. It is not the amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm the Public Information Manager for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. This is not our bill, but I can shed a little light. Current statute does say 25% for the fishing and hunting license. It is true the United States Department of Veterans Affairs does do disabilities in zeros, 0, 10, 50, or 0, 10, 20, 30, up to 100%. The statute has worked with 25 because what happens is you get a letter from the Department of Veterans Affairs that says this veteran is rated 30% or more in order to get your qualification to get this current fishing and hunting license.
Okay.
In order to get this license, you have to have this letter from the Department of Veterans Affairs. So the letter does indicate you are above that 25% mark. So if you leave the statute at 25%, you're still going to get the letter from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs saying you are disabled at 30% or more.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and because we don't have a fiscal on the Dash 1, we can just do the original bill and... Because it will work. I was maybe being overly technical in my approach here.
All right. Do we have...
Yes, we have the fiscal.
I don't have it in my bill, and I was just wondering why...
I've got one.
You got one? For some reason... Wait. Here it is. Got it. Okay. With that, we're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 400 to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 400 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Well, a clerk will call the roll.
Okay, Senator B.
Excused.
Senator Morissette.
Excused.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monahan.
Aye. Motion carried, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and with that, we'll close the work session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My one bill of the session.
Yes, Senate Bill 400. And what I'd like to do is open, I closed that 400, and now I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 700. Mr. Shook. Yeah, there it is.
Oh. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 700 creates a task force on veterans reintegration, and one of the bills that came out of the veterans task force.
And I know that Senator Schrader wanted to come. I don't know if her staff or anyone is listening. If you could call her office to see if she still would like to. But I'd like to call up General Mike Caldwell, Jim Willis, and Paul Evans.
We don't have fiscal on it yet, do we?
No.
And that's unfortunate.
Go ahead, Paul. Chair Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here. I'm going to lay out the rationale for this, and then as the senator gets here, I'm sure she's going to want to pop in and explain more. Senate Bill 700 is, at first glance, one of those things where we just had a task force that created a number of recommendations, as you know. We also recognized through the process, as I've told you earlier about transportation, I believe, that there were a couple of things that we were not able to get accomplished in the time that we had. One of which is what we're here before you today asking for, which is legislative sanction, legislative support for taking what is working well right now and actually expanding it down to a lower level. And here's what I mean by that. Every 6 months, thanks to the hard work of Brigadier General Caldwell and the entire reintegration team, every 6 months, folks that are involved in veterans policy get together for a summit. And what the purpose really is at that point is to make sure information is consistent across the board and to have networking opportunities to make sure that folks are getting the best care with the resources that are available. We recognize throughout the state that depending on where you live, the local network of support is either developed or maybe not so developed. In Eugene, for example, they have the VetNet, which has been going on for some 30-plus years. The Portland metropolitan area has a number of organizations that really meet constantly and are able to make sure that information is shared. In other parts of the state, it's not so much. And what we were trying to do is come up with the most rational way to figure out how to have local communities and local networks get together on either a every 2 month or every 3 month basis to make sure that those local efforts were ongoing, so that when we come together every 6 months, we have a little bit longer reach and we have a little bit better information coming in, and at the same time we have more ability to put information out. Here's one of the reasons why. As we spent time on the road trying to track down just who does what in veterans policy across the state, there's 28 plus organizations that believe they have the master calendar and they know everything that's going on. It's kind of like playing telephone, right? So about two of them really do, and even at that, it's an 85% reach. The military department and ODVA have very good information, but even that doesn't include all the local stuff. So what we're hoping to do with this bill is to send a clear message that the work of coordination and collaboration should continue, and that with this bill, we can have legislative sanction to build up a structure to make sure that state and federal partners involved are involved at even the most local level to make sure that information flows. In all honesty, this is one of those issues where if the bill doesn't get passed, we'll continue to try to do the work. But with the legislature saying it's a priority for you, it helps us by opening some doors to local entities that so far haven't been as engaged as they could be. I hope that answers the question.
Yes. I was so impressed when I went over to the armory. Is that what you call it?
Yes, ma'am.
The armory, mm-hmm. And you had all of these people, and I thought you were sort of working on reintegration. You had, when I went to speak to the various groups, you had the education, the health, you had the employment. You had all these different groups of people, and a lot of people there. Could you just comment on that? I was so impressed, and I'm sure that...
Chair Anderson, yes, absolutely. Again, he's not going to blow his own horn, but due to the leadership of Brigadier General Caldwell and Colonel McRae and Jack Himes and Director Willis and a whole lot of folks that made it happen, we have every 6 months mental health, employment, education, family issues, the entire gambit of services providers come together to make sure that we have the best information available. What we're trying to do is actually build on that success and take it down to the next level, to county and local level, to be able to provide them some support to make sure that the information ability is consistent across the plain. Depending on where you live in Oregon, for example, Burns, Oregon, they work very hard to do with what they have, but they just don't have some of the capacity that other communities may have. So what we're trying to do is, with this task force, put it out there that the state of Oregon is going to not only accept what's going on every 6 months as the standard, but to build on that and to hopefully provide a little bit of top cover to allow agencies that haven't participated so far to participate. And we're trying to drive it to a bi-monthly or quarterly basis to make sure that the veteran that does get the information is getting the right information at the right time.
Thank you. Senator Schrader's here, so let's have her speak.
Oh, thank you, colleagues. I am Senator Martha Schrader from Canby in Clackamas County. Thank you for allowing me to be here this morning with you. I was in my committee, and I want to thank my staff for pulling me out at the appropriate time. I'm here today in support of two bills, Senate Bill 725, dealing with women's veterans and health care issues, as well
and I can open a public hearing on 725, too, so you can speak to both of them.
Well, I'll just say briefly, I am in support of that. I think that's a critical need that was identified by the task force as we did our work, the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services. But what I'm going to particularly speak about today is Senate Bill 700. And I think that all of you realize that I am very concerned about the reintegration of our military men and women and their families into everyday life, largely because we are facing, I've said this numerous times, the largest deployment of our folks since World War II. They've sacrificed so much for us, and I believe that we need to step up to the plate and really make our attempts at their reintegration as smooth as possible. I believe that Senate Bill 700 will attempt to replicate some of the more successful models of reintegration that the state has seen in a very long time. In particular, it brings together a plethora of state agencies who, in one form or another, deal with these issues. It will enable us as legislators to track how they are going to be working when our folks return home. And in particular, at least from my perspective, it will pull together a model, I think, that is statewide, coordinated, cohesive, so when the time comes, we will be able to respond to their needs. I know that all of you will be, I'm assuming, in support of this bill because you know the critical nature of what we are going to be dealing with as our veterans return home. So, again, thank you for allowing me to be here this morning, and I am very proud that the legislature during this critical time for our military people is attempting to step up to the plate for their welfare.
And I think, too, that because I'm so concerned about the mental health, the traumatic brain injury, the suicide, we have more actually kill themselves at the hands of their own rather versus how many had been killed overseas in the war, post-traumatic stress, as well as suicide, and all of those, and sexual trauma. All of those are real issues, and that's what I'm so impressed with the reintegration, and we need to be getting down to the local level in talking about these things. So it's, I think, very good.
Thank you for that, Madam Chair, because I think we do all know that the data showing that it's increasing dramatically with the folks that are returning home in terms of, as you said, suicide issues, mental health issues, family violence actually is increasing drastically. And so, I think the term that we've been trying to use is prepare as well as repair. And so if we prepare adequately, again, I think a lot of these issues can be dealt with in a way that will be helpful for those folks. So
thank you.
All right. Great.
And I'll actually close the public hearing on 725, and then we're still with 701. Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today and recommend support on Senate Bill 700. I think, as Mr. Evans has explained, it's a fairly broad category. I will give you just a little bit of history on our reintegration program. As you witnessed when you were down at the Anderson Readiness Center or Armory, it is a very robust and full spectrum group of citizens that are participating in this. I have to admit, when we started this program in 2004, there was a good deal we didn't understand about reintegration. The fact is, we didn't have a clue. And we recognized we were having problems. We needed to do something. And we didn't know exactly what to do. There was no federal program because it was pretty much confined to military bases and dealing with the units. And we still got issues that we've discovered. We were fortunate in that our governor and commander-in-chief, Governor Kulongoski, we went to him and said, we need some resources. The federal government isn't providing those. We need some money. Will you help us? And he said he would. It was a rather personal thing for me, quite frankly, because the 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, that was is headquartered out of Eugene and getting ready to deploy again. They were in Iraq. They had 9 members of their organization killed. In a short span of time, and actually 2 incidents, major incidents. One of those young men was a lieutenant who I knew very well. His father and I worked together when we were enlisted young men years ago out in Eastern Oregon. And Lieutenant McCrae's dad had just retired. And I remember when that boy was born. He played with my children. He was a stellar young man. He graduated early from high school, graduated early from Linfield with 2 degrees in science and mathematics, and was truly the best and the brightest this state or this nation has to offer. And he was leading his men when he was killed. I asked his dad, which was even more difficult, because of his ability and my experience with him as my executive officer years ago, to head up our reintegration team. And Colonel McCrae, retired, has done that and done a stellar job. Perhaps maybe that's part of some of the helped in this whole, his own reintegration, his father and his mother. The program's been successful. It was modeled nationally. It's now become a set piece for the rest of the National Guard units. But as I said, in 2004, we did not know what we were doing. We were trying to build a bicycle while we rode it. I credit, the good work of many, many volunteers and interested people throughout this state, to include educators, employers, healthcare providers, and our families. Those are the 4 key areas that we try to focus on. And I credit those people for standing up and helping us here, but I go back to that incident of recognizing that we really had some issues and we had to figure out a way to solve them. We've not completely solved every problem. I will tell you this, this is a tough budget time and I understand all those issues. Believe me, I do. I've been here doing this business long enough that I get it. But we have 2.5 state positions that run this program, 2.5 FTE. And those are going to be cut in this budget, as well as 25 armories are scheduled to be cut with a 30% reduction level. So we're going to send these folks off to war, and then we're going to close their buildings behind them. And I would highly recommend, I have no problem with this bill. We want to outreach, we want to get out there, but there's a reality in this business where if we're going to do these sort of things, we're going to have to pay for them. And that doesn't, we got conflict going between our needs and our wants and our ability to pay for them, and I know that you'll work that out, and I'm not here to pitch my budget, but I will tell you that we run this thing on a shoestring right now, and we're doing as much as we can. We're swimming as fast as we can upstream. So we'll continue to do it, even if we have to do it. We have to do bake sales on the backs of M1 tanks. We will do that if that's what it requires to help these folks, because these are our most important assets, are our people. And we've got to do the right thing for not only them when they return, but also their families while they're gone. Thank you.
There should be federal dollars aimed at this. I mean, what's the situation?
Senator Anderson, Monis Anderson, and Senator Moore said there is. It was late coming to the game. A lot of it had to do, frankly, with Representative Darlene Hooley when she was in the Congress of the United States, literally raising hell and putting a prop under it to make sure that she got what she wanted. And we did get some money. Now we've got family program people. We used to have 1 person for the entire state, 8,500 guardsmen. We have now 1 full-time person hired by the federal government, and then we've got 4 contractors that that we hire through the federal government funds. In the reintegration program, we have three people in the state that are out in the regions. They're not kegged up here in Salem. And those three are paid for by the federal government, along with some money for automobiles and travel. It's a very small amount of money, but we had nothing when we started in 2004. And so we've moved a long way with respect to that, but it's still fairly inadequate when you really get down to the necessary needs that these folks have. The reason we've been successful, and I know we have been successful, is because we've had tremendous support from state agencies. We've had tremendous support from non-governmental agencies, including the veterans groups, as well as other folks that have stepped up that we didn't even know existed. And they've come to the table and said, we want to help. That's why we've been as successful as we have been.
Madam, just a quick follow-up. What about the future? What about now? I mean, there's a new administration. There's a new emphasis. There's new concerns. Federally, there should be. And is there any additional money available?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I'm not aware of any in this next proposal in the budget. I guess at this point, we're hoping for maintenance to keep what we have. Yeah, I'll just be real honest with you. This is not a big item on most people's agenda, is the reintegration. And I think largely due to the fact that most of the folks that make the decisions at the Pentagon and write budgets, they look at it from an active duty standpoint, where you've got a base or a fort, and you've got everybody inside your fence, and you've got all those resources sitting around that location. We don't. We're Fort Oregon. We don't have Fort Lewis. We don't have Fort Hood. We have Fort Oregon, and this fort's a big fort, and so it causes a lot more difficulty. I think, as Paul mentioned in his testimony, some of the most profound testimony was when we get out in the task force the governor put together on these issues. You get out to LeGrand, Baker, Burns, and then you really find out what the issue is. In fact, just yesterday, I still take my hometown paper in LeGrand, and here was an article on the front page about the veterans, which there's a bill in this session about transportation for veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And here was a picture of a 71-year-old man and a 78-year-old man, and they were the drivers for that van to get people to Walla Walla for their... Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not the way we should be doing business, and not that they're not good people. One guy even had his cane with him. You know, so, I mean, it's an adventure when you get in that van to get to the VA hospital to get your treatment. So... It's an issue that is across the country for veterans. It's an issue for guardsmen and reservists who do not have that mothership to connect to right across the street like you do on an active duty boat base. And we've got to find workarounds. I agree it should be 100% federally funded. It's not. So we have to find workarounds to make sure that we get the...
Even matching.
Yeah.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Borsett, I'd like to expand on that just a little bit, and I'll probably be as impolite as the general has been polite about the past administration. History will judge the last administration for a lot of things, but as a veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan, the thing that should haunt the last administration was how at the same time we ramped up to go to war, we didn't keep up with the needs of the veteran population, and more importantly, that the one thing that every certified smart guy on both sides of the partisan aisle could understand about a war in Iraq and Afghanistan was that if we didn't have a large enough force to do it, there was going to be an impact on the Guard and Reserve without a draft. And because we didn't solve problems then, we have continued to watch more problems grow over time. So when you talk about the federal dollars involved in this process, it was a fight just to get the amount that's there. But the amount that's there isn't sufficient for last year. And it's sure not going to be sufficient for next year as we continue to rely on the Guard and Reserve in ways we never have historically. The fundamental problem is that right now the DOD is undergoing a huge transformation to get ready to get out of Iraq and try to figure out what they're going to do in Afghanistan so they don't lose that one too quickly, so it looks like we lost two wars at the same time. Now, they're probably not going to say that in polite audiences, but that is, in fact, what they're doing. So the concern about how they're treating folks during reintegration is not at the top of their bubble. On top of that, you have Congress right now trying to figure out how to spell trillion with all kinds of packages. So they think, in their mind, this is fixed. But the thing about Oregon that the general talked about that is fundamentally different than at least 40 other states. We don't have active duty bases around, so we don't have that capacity to plan. We can't count on the retired groups. We can't count on some of the VFW and the American Legion halls as much as other states can, because they've got that critical mass. So we never had enough to begin with, and the amount that the federal government is throwing at this problem is still insufficient. And it's going to continue to be insufficient, because when we didn't solve problems 3 years ago, it isn't like a person comes home and they automatically have challenges. It's that second, that third, that fourth, that fifth year out where things start being able to be more than they can handle. And that's where we need to make sure that we help. And another thing I want to emphasize while we have the moment, reintegration isn't just about the folks coming back this war. This reintegration team will help any veteran of any time to help make sure that those needs are taken care of. And that's important as the Vietnam era generation is coming to terms with what was and what is. And while we didn't put this in the bill, I want to assure the members of the committee that the goal of this is to make sure that there is something in place for those out years, that we have those relationships formed and that communication process in place, so that when the next session and the session after that and the session after that come in, the communication about veterans' issues is steady state. We're not continuing to rebuild the bicycle. We're making the bicycle faster and better. So we just, again, anything that you can do on this, mm-hmm. It is a critical time.
And it wouldn't hurt. I know some people think our resolutions to Congress don't mean anything, but we can think about doing that next session if you would want to prepare those. I think Oregon needs to be on the forefront of this. I don't have a problem with moving it down to Ways and Means once we have a fiscal. We'll see what the rest of the committee wants. But if we could start getting our message out to Congress, too, on this.
And Chair Monson Anderson, members of the committee, one last comment about a bill you haven't quite heard yet, but I know it's going to come up soon. The May 8th Military Family Appreciation Day. If we do this right, all the veterans' package will be prepared for that day for the governor's signature. Oregon will send a clear message, not just to Congress, but across the country, that we have done what the state can do given the current circumstances, and now it's the Congress's turn.
I want to thank you, too, for your email that I got, because I immediately forwarded it to my committee regarding the May 8th, and we had Gail Hanna and a group who really have, veterans are near and dear, and we're actually creating a memorial, a Heroes Memorial in right downtown Gresham, right across from Jazzy Bagel, and they are just so excited to be able to participate and plant a tree on that particular day, so it'd be nice to get some more legislators to get involved with their own community on that. Okay, comments on this particular bill? We do not have a fiscal, so if Mr. Shipp would request that, and if there's any other comments?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. You have my director's written testimony. The department supports this and sees this as part of the integrated strategy of the task force. So that's a key component to making sure that the whole integrated strategy of the packages you've seen go forward.
Thank you. Okay. I think Mr. Krupp would like to come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm former State Representative Jeff Krupp. This issue is very dear to my heart. I have the absolute honor of being an embedded broadcaster with the Oregon National Guard, with the 2 of the 162 in Iraq in 2004 and the 41st Brigade in Afghanistan in 2006. And I will tell you from personal experience and talking with soldiers, which I did a lot of there, that the issues that my two friends here have articulated are powerful in their lives. When they're deployed and they're away from their kids and their families, I sat next to a soldier over Thanksgiving in a room where soldiers are connected by computers and video cameras to their family members, and listened to this man argue and fight with his wife. That marriage wasn't going to last. These are tough circumstances for our soldiers. And I think we have an absolute moral imperative to make sure that we fund the reintegration team. I've talked to a lot of soldiers, not only members who are part of the reintegration team that's helped them heal from war wounds, but soldiers who've been positively impacted by these soldiers acting as a friend and a mentor to them, someone who's lived what they're living through when they come home. Now, a few moments ago, I got an email from the owner of our radio station. I do a morning radio talk show and out of Hillsboro. And he's proposing a program an opportunity for our radio station to partner with other people to be a blessing for our soldiers. And I'm going to suggest to him that we try to find a way to use that program to help fund the reintegration team, because I know how powerfully important it is to do this. It should be one of our highest priorities here, because we've asked so much of these soldiers. I'm going to tell you, I've served on Ways and Means. You know, I served 8 years in this body. And there's spending that is not of a high a priority as what this meager little program is that has such a powerful impact. And we owe it to the soldiers. And I can help you find that, but I'm going to offer that up to my radio station. I'm going to offer it up to my two friends right here to try to find a way that we can fund this. This is a critical budget shortfall. I know that. I get that. I understand the choices that you guys are having to make. But we can find a way to do this, and I would hope that maybe we could partner with you in doing that also. And that's all I have to say. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for indulging.
Thank you very much. All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 700 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 725.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 725 creates yet another task force on women's veterans health care.
Now, I know that Senator Johnson wanted to maybe testify on this, so if you could contact their staff to see if she could be here. And is the same group signing up for this? I don't have the witness witness registration. So Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Jim Wallace, and Paul Evans, although Jim's not here, right?
Paul is the task force chairman to start it off.
Okay. Chairman Miles Anderson, members of the committee, I'll try to keep this as brief as I can. As Mr. Shook indicated, there are three task forces that the task force is asking for. Honest to God, we used to use the term work group. I'd prefer that, but we were told that we have to use the term task force. We're going to use task force. And it goes back to the fact that when I was a young firefighter back in the day, I learned that some fires are just awful big, and you got to kind of do what you can do when you can. We spent the year doing what we could. The recommendations that you've seen and given time to consider were the output of that. But there were several issues: transportation, the way in which to create a local reintegration strategy, and quite frankly, the myriad of issues related to women veterans' health and women veterans in general were larger than our time for the task force. So one of the things that we recognized is that fundamentally the Department of Veterans Affairs, who again right now are trying to do the best they can with what they got, was geared toward the traditional view of who a soldier was and who a soldier wasn't. And while it's tried to make adjustments incrementally, we as a country still have yet to come to terms with the fact that the 101st Airborne has combat medics that are women. But that's the case. We have fundamentally not yet figured out as a country that women are in combat, even though there are certain legal distinctions of what job title they have. Being shot at is pretty much being shot at. And if the person treating the infantryman is a woman and the infantryman is a guy, it really doesn't matter gender. They're going through the same kinds of things. And yet, because the VA was structured the way it has been, and because our society is still coming to terms with this transformation, there are issues that are unique to women veterans that we just have not paid enough attention to. And when it comes to issues of military sexual trauma, when it comes to issues of just basic health concerns, when it comes to access to programs that are not easy to get for male veterans, but certainly harder to get for women veterans, we recognize that there was some work to do. And one of the focus, major focus of this was to try to put together a group that could really do two things. The first was to find a way for Oregon to lead the charge and develop a facility in east of the mountains and a facility in the valley dedicated to women veterans inpatient care. And the fact is that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs doesn't have enough capacity for women veterans right now. They're trying. There have been some initiatives, but the fact is there's just not enough capacity for women-only areas. And for some of those issues that women veterans have had to go through, simply having a women's bed at a male facility is just not adequate. just not good enough. Also, having to do with family issues, we recognize that the VA, again, the traditional male model, the veteran can be enrolled, but there's no consideration for the family. Well, some things have changed. Women are in combat. Some things haven't changed. Women often still end up with the kids. So why is it that a woman is penalized for trying to take care of her kids because she can't take advantage of the VA program for in-residence care because she's still got to figure out a place to put the kids? We can do better than that. And while we don't know, at least I'm certainly not smart enough to figure out what the answers are, we do know that it's a big enough pot of work that if you can give us a task force and again, the legislative sanction to say, State of Oregon, this is important to us, figure out ways to do this, that we certainly could use that opportunity. So I'm going to stop there and respond to any questions.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
That's interesting. My sister, who was an Army nurse captain in World War II, goes to the Palo Alto Veterans Hospital regularly. She gets excellent care. She's been there for a variety of concerns, illnesses. What's the difference between her care and a woman veteran in Iraq coming out? And don't they have the same privileges in the Veterans Hospital?
Chairman Anderson, Senator Moore said they do have the same. That's actually, that part is true. Access is an issue the more remote and rural you get, as well as the whole family concept issue. And quite frankly, the needs are a little bit different, too, in that World War II, Vietnam, some numbers I think can be helpful here. During Vietnam, about 7,500 women served during Vietnam, mostly in the medical and the medical career field. 185,000 women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now they're in, for all intents and purposes, they're in open combat. So the kinds of care that they need is different than what have traditionally been accessible to women. And quite frankly, system-wide, there isn't enough capacity for male or female veterans. And then you put on top of that military sexual trauma, which actually does occur with male veterans, but is clearly much more of an impact on women veterans. Those services just haven't really... We haven't funded them. The government hasn't really gotten to that point yet. And the government really is still struggling, the federal government is still struggling with this whole family concept, that women who have children, that there's not money set aside to make sure that the kids are taken care of as the woman gets care. So for basic medical care or even the traditional kinds of a hospital care, once women get access, they get access to one of the best medical systems in the world. The challenge is that because women are now in combat more than they have been before, access to those kinds of supports just don't exist, or if they do, are very rare.
Madam Chair, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department, but Senator Morissette, maybe to come closer to what your focus a little tighter. We had a female soldier who was experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. She had clearly could not be dealt with in an outpatient format, which was what we were trying to do with the Portland VA. She definitely needed inpatient care, according to the VA. She was sent home because there were no beds in Portland. The type of specialized care that the VA had that dealt with this was superb care, but it was in Palo Alto, and there were 12 beds for females west of the Mississippi. Therein lies the real problem. What we attempted to do, and we were unsuccessful, was to try to get community-based care and get the VA to pick up the tab, which is, you're probably better off trying to figure out the zeros in a trillion than you are getting that done through the process. It's been about 2 years ago. We're hoping that's going to change and things will get better inside the VA because we've seen some improvements, some clear improvements inside the federal VA. But nevertheless, that is the essence of the issue. When you've got 12 beds west of the Mississippi and you've got this kind of, and this is specialized care. It isn't the normal, you know, I've got a shoulder injury or I got a leg injury or something like that. This is specialized. So that's really what we're talking about here is this is care that's going to take more than a outpatient-type situation. They've got to be able to be inpatient. They've got to be supported while they're there and then get the specialized care that they desperately need. And that's really what this, I think, the focus of this will be and then should be. Otherwise, they're treated the same as any other veteran, and they get good care with respect to those kind of things. And we support the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Willis, do you want to say anything?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've submitted written testimony in support of Senate Bill 725, so I won't read that. I will just make this one comment as it relates to one of the illnesses associated with direct combat, and that is the military sexual trauma. Because of the nature of that particular illness, there are, for many, many good reasons, women, Armed Forces veterans who do not want to be treated by a male, no matter how professional that person is. The VA has recognized this and is working to match up through its entire health system female medical professionals who know how to deal with the symptoms and the treatment of military sexual trauma. And I applaud their efforts in doing that, and I hope they're successful in having those practitioners across the country, and of course certainly in Portland, Roseburg, and other treatment facilities here in Oregon. I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Roland.
Chair Moss-Anderson, members of the committee, if I could just close with one little statistic that I kind of want you to be thinking about as we go forward. As you know, Governor Kulongoski attends military services for fallen troops. Five of the last 10 have been self-inflicted. It is a matter of time before women are in that category, women veterans are in that category at similar proportions. It's a matter of time. We have an opportunity now to recognize a gap that the federal government currently has, and in the short term, at least do what we can with what we have for the women veterans that are doing everything they can for us. The suicide rate that's currently being recognized to climb will get worse as this war continues, especially among the Guard and Reserve and the folks that don't have any other place to go in a state as diverse and large as Oregon without some of those support mechanisms. So I just want to throw that into the mix.
Thank you. Comments?
All right. We are waiting for a fiscal, so Mr. Shirk should say there are no amendments to this bill either. Yay. So we can go ahead with a fiscal on that. With that, I'd like to close. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Close the public hearing on 725 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 556.
Work session.
Work session on 556. We will not be moving it today because we have other amendments, but Senator Haas is just sitting there observing in case we need him. Would you remind us?
Madam Chair, this bill was heard about 3 weeks ago. Senate Bill 556 requires certain places of public assembly to have automated external defibrillators, and the owner of the place of public assembly ensures that the staff person trained in the use of the defibrillator is present when place of public assembly is open to the public. And we have two amendments and dash three amendments.
So Bill Cross wants to address the dash two amendments and come forward. It's work session. And then which amendments were yours?
Dash threes.
Dash threes. So first let's see what your dash twos are addressing, and then we'll have Senator Bates address what the dash threes are addressing.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today representing BOMA, Building Owners and Managers Association. And we've been working with the sponsor of the legislation on the Dash 2 amendments in part to redefine what kinds of public buildings would be included in the definition. And originally there was the definition kind of included buildings that would be could hold 500 or more people, and frankly it's easier to probably define what the by square footage. So the dash twos say you would have to be required to have a defibrillator if your building is 50,000 square feet or larger, and also meets the definition of, you know, business activities, entertainment, et cetera, et cetera. The other provisions in the dash two address the liability for commercial building owners. If the Good Sam legislation that we have, frankly, is difficult. You still have insurance exposures, and we're trying to make this as cost effective as possible for commercial building owners to comply with and provide a defibrillator, to frankly have a trained person on site in buildings. Some of these commercial buildings open 24 hours a day. It just isn't very practical. So we wanted to try and be in a position to require the buildings to have the defibrillators, but to minimize then our exposure with respect to some of the other kind of good SAM requirements already in statute for other situations.
That's Thank you. Dash two. Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that the definition of the assembly that would require or where you have a public assembly, would that include warehouse space? I mean, it says business activities are conducted. Now, that's pretty broad language, and there are thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of square footage of warehouse.
Five people
in the state.
That's a good point.
Five people.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I think it would, because we went to the 50,000, and it may be that some two-part test or something, or define out industrial warehouse, I mean, certain business activities that I don't think the sponsor and I certainly were envisioning when we were kind of talking about, you know, business activities and building, you know, commercial buildings, that type of thing. So, but you'd have to talk to the sponsor perhaps about whether his intentions included warehouses. We never really talked about them, so my guess is probably not.
Mm-hmm. Senator Haas.
Thank you. Mark Haas, Senate District 14. Madam Chair, Senator Morse, this did come up, and I had a discussion with AOI about this very issue, and they finally said we're okay, that yes, there are warehouses where you don't have a lot of employees, but you have some, and you have enough where this is not enough of a concern, at least for that organization, to want to amend that, because I offered it. And they're okay with this language. And if they were here, they could speak for themselves. But I think that's what they would say. The other issue on this point, you know, I'm sort of testifying against my own idea here. So that's that's brilliant. So storage, self-storage areas, but they're okay too. So there are people there, and for now. They didn't take me up on my offer to sort of placate any concerns they might have.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Senator Morse does have a point, and I think we need to maybe think about it a little bit, because you can have a warehouse with three or four employees that certainly fits this description, and I don't think that's not what we're targeting with this necessarily. So,
I would appreciate if we had better definition, so that we don't send the legislation out and we have folks saying, holy cow, what did you do to us? We just don't have people in this building.
Because I could envision litigation.
Well, we were, Madam Chair, looking at Washington Square, or, you know, big department stores, office buildings, that sort of thing. I don't think, but we there are, I know a lot of facilities that are warehouse facilities. Some have a lot of employees, clearly. Mm-hmm. Some do not. So, you know, and actually, I have a facility that's 10,000 square feet and all that's in its machinery. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, Madam Chair, committee, I did survey people. There's a Pacific Coast Fruit in Portland. They have large, right, large warehouse space, several hundred thousand square feet, and they've got 175 employees.
Right.
And they have a warehouse in Tualatin they also have, you know, 50 or 60 employees there. So when I asked the president, he's, you know, most warehouses do have a number of people. It's more than you might think. So far this hasn't seemed like an unreasonable amendment to any of them. And maybe that's counterintuitive or not, but that's what I found out.
Well, Madam Chair, it's just, for those sorts of facilities, I have no problem. But there are, I know a lot of farm, you can go up I-5 and look at a lot of farm buildings that fit this criteria that are full of hay.
Mm-hmm.
Are
that 50,000 square feet or
more? Yeah. 50,000 square feet isn't all that big.
Okay.
So, like I say, I'm thinking about this now, and I think I have two buildings that fit this criteria that there's nobody in hardly ever, unless I'm going to get a piece of machinery or something like that. So, and to either make a requirement that I have to have a defibrillator there or I'm breaking the law, I think is a bit much. So I agree with Senator Morris. I think that we need to do some sort of definition. Maybe we need to put the number of people or something like that in as well,
or defining public assembly.
I wouldn't argue that point other than I've offered this and my offer was turned down by business groups because of the realities that exist out there where there are a fair number of employees there. We talked about this in the earlier version with just numbers of people, but this was decided to be a better definition. So, I'm fine with whatever we ultimately decide, but I can tell you that aside from this, there hasn't been any pushback or any acceptance of an offer to define this further.
I know that the trial lawyers had a concern, too. Is anyone in the audience there to address their concerns? And I think it was regarding this.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I could, just before
or
they
not.
Come up, I'm
They're
just
okay.
wondering if we eliminated B, if that covers
it. I'll just go in there.
Off what page?
It was
an amendment.
Section 1B. So we're just dealing with public congregates for the purpose such as deliberation, shopping, entertainment, amusement, or waiting transportation. Because, trust me, people don't go to hay barns for amusement. But you can have a barn dance, I understand that. But business activities is a really broad definition, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Business activities, though, in a 16-story building would not be covered then if you got rid of B, and that's where we would want to have it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there's a... I see that.
All right.
Yes. This is the art of the possible, not the perfect. Business activities and had a C and where X employees
at least 25
employees would I think cover the concerns that I have because I'm thinking about structures in my district I know and AOI doesn't necessarily represent them mm-hmm. that would call me and say what have you done to me
mm-hmm.
like a huge mm-hmm. cold storage facility. Mm-hmm. There are not too many people working inside that cold storage facility.
Right.
Senator Bates?
Yeah, I think like aircraft hangars mm-hmm. and things of that nature. I think B needs to be, if you modify B with some kind of statement of how many people are involved, I think you get it there.
Yeah,
I think you're there. I think it's well written and you're there.
I don't think that's a problem.
That would probably hit it.
Will you take care of
it? I will take care of it.
Okay.
Because I do like the bill, that. So.
Well, I notice you are a co-chief sponsor here, and you're arguing against it.
I'm arguing to make it a better bill.
I now would like to address the -3 amendments. It doesn't look like we're going to get to Senate Bill 456 for those in the audience, so we're just going to finish up with this one. Okay.
Madam Chair, these are my amendments. These are offered to as cleanly and purposely to kill the bill.
Okay.
shot in the head. I called it up. It was just great. And a long-term relationship. I'm trying to end a long time with this guy and get it over with. But no, seriously, we know that there's a high probability that there will be a capital improvement fund made available to K-12 coming out of the House. And it will be substantial. And what I was thinking is this is something that would be appropriate for schools to tap into. These defibrillators will probably have a life expectancy, you're not counting the batteries, of 10 to 15 years. And clearly they're a capital improvement. The question that crossed my mind, made it difficult for me, was one, when I saw the Dash 2s, there's some language in the Dash 3s that may be contradictory to the Dash 2s. We need to look at that very carefully so we match up the size of the buildings and what we just discussed so that one doesn't contradict the other. The other piece is whether or not it's appropriate to offer this as amendment at this level or whether we offered it as an amendment in full waste means as a friendly amendment.
As a budget note.
Or as a budget note towards when that capital improvement project comes through. So I might well pull this back. I want to make sure the language is clean, though, so it matches the rest of the bill. I would like to work with the chief sponsor with it and find a funding way to do what I think is the most important place to put these, which is schools. I'd rather see this in schools than any place else, so that's the one place we exempted because of cost. So we have an opportunity to fund this at that level. What's nice about doing it here, though, is I can, if I offer this amendment now, I get the chance to get a physical done on it. And I might need that in ways and means. So
we can still request once you have the amendment.
What I want to do is I want to do the amendment, not put the bill yet, but ask for the physical on it.
Mm-hmm.
That would guide me in full ways and means.
Because we wouldn't want to then have the schools testifying on whether they would want their capital fund monies being used this way.
Right.
And that's another issue.
Madam Chair, I might add that through legislation we passed in 2005, the department is directed to look for foundations money and grant money to help districts purchase defibrillators.
It might be interesting to know how they have proceeded on those efforts, Mr. Education Chair.
Yes. I'm sure once we get the physical, I think that if in fact the capital improvement bill comes through, this will be a rounding error for that bill. The amount of money involved, I think, will be so small, it will hardly be noticeable, but the impact could be huge. And just I had a finer point to it. There was a lawsuit that is going forward, and has been, I understand, settled in Washington State, in which the lack of health care for a child who died in that state last year was settled in favor of the family. And I think schools will soon be facing a liability if they don't have these present. This was not for a defibrillator. It was for not having something for an asthmatic child. But I think our schools are going to be at increasing risk for having what is considered reasonable. And I can just see it happening that we get these out in the public. Schools don't have them. We have a sporting event and somebody dies, and that district is liable. I can just see it coming. So I think we need to look at this very carefully.
We'd hate to spend a lot of time on that.
So you have direction, and please work. I would like to make sure you're on board with whatever, and I do not know how the committee feels about the Dash 3s.
We'll upgrade the Dash 2s, and your administrator has been fabulous to work with. So.
Excellent. Do that. All right. I apologize for overbooking us today. I didn't realize that our first bill was going to take an hour, so I apologize for that. And next time we will...
you never know.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I just want you to know I'm not going to be here on Saturday.
Okay. All right. Well, we will be carrying over all.
Tonight, Bill.
We will be carrying over all the bills that we did not hear.
I'm not going to be here.
And because it even 556. Do we want 529?
Right. Yeah. Everything will be carried over, with the exception of 701, 725, 700, and 400.
Yep.
Got that.
And once we have the fiscal, then you can schedule them. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 556, and we're adjourned.